This is Geek Speak, episode 31 of season 17. Babylonian NSA finds tiny antennas at Whole Foods. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the air room is Mr. Miles Elam, programmer, a pedantic.
Pedant.
See? Welcome, Miles.
Always a pleasure. How you doing?
I'm quite well, thank you. A little bit of follow-up. Quite a while ago, in fact, July 1st, 2017, the episode of Geek Speak that we covered this was Thanks, Alexa, Go Sue My Car, was the title. And we talked a little bit about a person suing Apple because they patented technology that would enforce someone not to text and drive. The person that was suing actually lost a family member due to an accident where the person had an iPhone and they were texting and driving and they had an accident and killed a loved one. So they were suing Apple for not implementing the patent that they had designed. This week, a judge threw out the lawsuit saying that Apple is not at fault for people texting and driving.
Seems legit. And we talked about that on the show, that it was kind of problematic. We were wondering how it would go because there is that thought process of if you patent something, you're cutting off someone else from implementing that.
Yeah, there is a bit of that validity. And if you want to hear that whole discussion, you can go listen to the July 21st, 2017 episode where we go into that in more detail. I don't want to rehash it. But
sure.
But yeah.
It's a settled case
settled
now.
That's true. That's true. Let's talk about Germany. What's the story about Germany and SpaceX? I do not understand.
Hyperloop is Elon Musk's project for very fast human transport,
yes,
but ground-based rather than in the air, where you have a tube, you evacuate the air, you don't have the wind resistance, the pods can move very quickly. He, however, stated he didn't have time to work on it, but he put all the designs that he had up for other people to look at. Other people have looked at it and thought it was very interesting. We've seen some progress there. One of those pieces of progress are regular competitions where they try to make a speed record within a small test trial hyperloop.
Mm-hmm.
Most recent one, and this was Germany's war team, and this was from the University of Munich, were able to get their maglev pod going through the nearly 1 mile long test tunnel.
Oh, that's a pretty good size.
Yeah. At a peak speed, you need to have it to accelerate.
Yeah.
They accelerated to a peak speed of 201 miles per hour or 324 kilometers per hour.
Wait, in a mile? Is this thing a loop? Is this a circle? Is this not a circle? That's pretty impressive to get up to that speed. I'm assuming decrease as well to zero,
yes,
velocity. Wow, that's pretty cool. So it's working so far.
Because well,
201 miles an hour is helpful. I mean, it needs to go up to like 600, I think.
Yeah, 600, I believe, was the target.
Speed.
Or yeah. 600 or 700 was the target, but yeah.
And so this is in Germany, I'm assuming.
I'm trouble finding
where they actually are.
Where they
actually
are.
It's the University of Technical, Germany's Technical University of Munich won the contest. Where they actually did it, we don't know.
Right.
Interesting.
Now, the thing behind it, and just to rehash for folks that are not aware or familiar with Hyperloop, if such a system were built, not just designed, not just tested, but then actually put into production,
mm-hmm,
you could get from Seattle to Portland in 15 minutes.
Seattle to Portland?
Yeah.
Okay.
Which would be quick.
That would be quick. I've also heard that San Francisco to Los Angeles in an hour and a half.
Right. The failure modes for this, there's that question of,
what about
bad
people dying?
Be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Obviously, planes are going at,
right,
600 miles an hour. You know, and so we're used to people going those speeds, but there's no falling from the sky and crashing. What happens if something goes on in the tube? So what happens if they do stuff like, if something goes wrong, the failure mode is you inject oxygen into the, into
air,
the tube. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Or air. Sorry. The mostly 80% nitrogen gas,
yes,
into the tube. Would that do such a strong stop that it would, you know, kill people from the rapid deceleration?
Right.
Or,
I would assume that, you know, even,
or would the inertia keep things smooth enough? These are all questions that are still open, or at least for...
And we definitely want to know that really well before, because, of course, we've been doing flight for 100 years. So we have a little bit of expertise in that field. Anyway, I'm really excited about more research. I'm glad to hear that multiple groups are actually investigating this. It seems like a no-brainer at some level. And, of course, the designs would theoretically have loops where pods would be ejected into a slower speed place to get on and off and not clog the entire system. Kind of imagine like a train system.
And to follow up, it was in fact in Hawthorne, California, my old neck of the woods.
Cool. I thought that there was a California-based Hyperloop investigation. I didn't know it was a German research group that was doing it.
Well, there are a bunch of different competitors are out there, including a student group from University of Washington. There are a wide variety of people there. It just so happens that the University of Munich group was the one who made the speed record.
Cool. Alexander Muse has written a Medium post claiming that he knows that the NSA has identified Satoshi Nakamoto. Now, Satoshi Nakamoto is the pen name of the person that invented Bitcoin. Person or persons that invented Bitcoin. There is some debate on whether it is an individual. But Bitcoin emerged as a fully functioning piece in the cryptocurrency and kind of started cryptocurrency as a serious contender. And the person that actually...
It effectively started cryptocurrency,
yes.
Period.
And the documentation about it and how it worked and all the source code and everything was released under this pen name. And the person, when they first initiated the system, this pen name actually has the... You could say that the starting of the system relies on finding unique numbers in this pattern. Okay, I won't get into the details of this. We have other shows on
also known as Bitcoin mining.
Yes, and the original mining was simpler than the more complicated mining. And when they first started the system, there was already quite a big, large blockchain of numbers that denotes early Bitcoins. And so this person that started this, if they actually have control of that wallet, is a billionaire at this point. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting that they have money. And there's been a lot of desire to surface who this person is. The story from Alexander Muse is that the Obama administration was concerned that Satoshi Nakamoto was potentially a state actor, could be controlled by or started up by maybe Russian, or Chinese group. And so whether that would be problematic for cryptocurrency or not is unknown, and whether it would be problematic for Bitcoin if a large percentage of the Bitcoin market could be affected by these early coins that are owned by this group. The desire supposedly from this article was the Obama administration wanted to know the motivation of this individual and who this person was. So there's been a lot of attempts to try to find out who this person is, and there has been some claims that people make that they are this person. But it would be very easy for this person to come about and say, this is who I am, because they have this large wallet of signed keys. So they have the private keys that everybody has public mm-hmm. keys of. In any case, the basic story is that the DHS decided to look...
Department of Homeland Security.
Thank you. Decided to look at using something called stylometry. Do you know what that is? The inspection of the structure of language to identify somebody, to fingerprint somebody. So you take texts, multiple texts, and you look at them and inspect them grammatically. And over a large corpus, you can produce a fingerprint of what another person, what the same person would write, how they would write, the style that they would write. And so using stylometry, one is able to compare text to determine authorship of a particular work. Throughout the years, Satoshi wrote thousands of posts and emails, and most which are in public available, and according to the source at NSA, was able to use the writer invariant method of stylometry to compare Satoshi's known writings with trillions of writing samples from people across the globe. This has been attempted by individuals before. The trouble is, though we have a good signature of known writings of this person, we don't have writings, generic writings of everybody on the planet to look at to mm-hmm. determine who it might be. Well, the NSA does have that because the NSA is able to use – first, let me describe what they actually supposedly did. Taking Satoshi's text and finding the 50 most common words, the NSA was able to break down the text into 5,000-word chunks and analyze each to find the frequency of those 50 words. This would result in a unique 50-number identifier for each chunk. The NSA then placed each of these numbers in a 50-dimensional space matrix, I assume, and flattened them into a plane using principal components analysis. And then the resulting fingerprint would then allow you to find any text and to compare it. So then the NSA was able to find bulk writing, and they found bulk writing using PRISM, which was the court-approved front door to Google and Yahoo email systems, and also through Muscular, which was the fiber sniffing that they were doing, that the NSA was doing. I think Google finally stopped. For a while, there's an assumption that when you have two server farms and you're communicating through a fiber line provided to you by a telco, that you didn't have to do SSL between those two points.
No, that actually was not the case, what was going on.
Oh, how did that sniffing happen? I remember that Google was vulnerable.
Between two data centers,
yeah,
the fiber connections were privately owned by Google. But you need to go through government actors for rights and for, you know, right-of-way rights,
right.
To be
no, they,
able to put
they
them down.
Owned, they owned them, yeah.
But they were owned outright by Google.
But they were
sniffed. Which is why they assumed there was the assumption of, well, we're the only ones on this network. We're the ones who laid down
the fiber.
The fiber. So therefore, we don't need to be encrypted between them. And so it was actually a state actor giving sanction to splice the wire to be able to look at that traffic.
Right. And so Google, because of that assumption, wasn't using SSL between those two points. And in fact, this was also affected Yahoo and Amazon and Facebook.
Yeah.
Now,
very shortly thereafter, Google started using SSL between data centers.
But there was quite a bit of time of that. Now, of course, that the system had to be in place to catch email. And then also through PRISM, which was the front door kind of system that was also put in place. So with those two things, the NSA has something that nobody else has. And that is trillions of emails from billions of people.
Mm-hmm.
And using that, supposedly, they were able to discover who he is or who they are. That's the thing, is that it's not clear from the source, from this article, that they actually pinned a person or multiple people. They're not talking about it. But they talk about how they did it, which is interesting. Now, of course, this is just a post from someone who, you know, has a good reputation, yeah, online.
Wow,
but of
he sounds like a
concern.
Pompous ass. It might be Miles Elam. Oh, wait, look, all the spelling errors. Must be Lyle.
Thanks. Anyway, I thought it was an interesting kind of write-up on how to discover somebody. And it also means, of course, that it's very hard to not be discovered if you want to keep... Oh, that's the thing about Satoshi Nakamoto. He, it, them have always wanted to be private. They've been very careful about doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's interesting in itself in a world where it's not common to have a successful privacy.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons why there was a thought there was a state actor. So there is a project, an open source project, that if you want to be anonymous, this can help you with your writing to make it more anonymous. It's up at GitHub, and it's called Anomouth. Anonymous and mouth smashed, mm-hmm, together. And basically it...
Anonymouth, yeah.
Anonymouth, yeah. And it basically, they actually run JSTELO, which is basically a detection system that allows you to see patterns in writing. So you effectively take all your writings and you stick it into this, you download the source, mm-hmm, code, you run the system, you stick your giant thing in, and it tries to make a unique fingerprint from your writings. And if it succeeds, it suggests that you change these things. Right after they describe how it works, they say very clearly, don't rely on this making you anonymous, because it's very difficult to do this kind of thing. I would assume the way to do this would be like write something and then use Google Translate or maybe another couple translating systems to translate it into multiple languages and back again. And over a period of time, you might lose your meaning completely, but then you could edit it again. But at least it wouldn't sound like you, hopefully. Miles, tell me about antennas.
Antennas, in general, that way that we transform electromagnetic emissions into electrical signals, which can be turned into data or sound, things like that, these have been around for, over 100 years?
Yeah.
well over 100 years. I'm trying to remember when Marconi first.
I think, I mean, the big public transmit was one of Hitler's speech at.
No, that was TV.
Yeah, but that was, well, it's radio. I mean,
I was thinking Marconi.
Marconi was, yeah. I'm just thinking of like a global event level. But yeah, radio's been around for a long time. I mean, the general idea of it's pretty simple. If you have an alternating current on an antenna or on a piece of wire, you induce a magnetic field that has the same characteristics of that electricity. If you take another wire, that will wire at any distance really can pick up that first signal. And all you have to do is make the wire the same length or similar length to the resonance of the frequency you're doing, or a harmonic derivative of a half or a quarter wave. And then you put AM and FM operate differently. There's multiple types of radio, but effectively AM is the simplest one to think of. You have high energy, lower energy is the signal variant. You have a carrier frequency. In any case, you take a small circuit that has a capacitor and an inductor on there, and using that as a resonance for the antenna, you can then pull data off of it and put it onto a speaker. So that's the basic idea of what an antenna works.
Right. But as you were saying, that antenna is directly related to the frequency you're trying to capture.
Yeah.
You may be able to do a quarter antenna, but that's still one quarter of the overall volume. And that's why you have, for example, that line on the back of your iPhone. You know, or yeah. Most phones have something embedded on there, or on your car you have a
whip. And yeah. Actually, what most of us now have is a sticker on our windshield, on our back windshield, that our back window that actually has a whole bunch of fingers. And you'll notice that all those fingers, if you look at the lines on the back of cars where the actual antenna is, you'll notice there's different lengths of them. And the reason for that is those are tuned to different frequency ranges in the FM band, and basically if you have enough of those, they'll resonate a certain frequency, and then the tuning can actually be pretty good about filtering out them. So in any case, you want a whole bunch of different lengths so that they resonate correctly.
All right, but that ends up being a fair length.
Yeah.
Some engineers have published the ability to make an antenna for wireless communications that's 100 times smaller than a typical size.
Okay.
We're talking sub-millimeter.
Well, that means it'd be highly less efficient unless they're doing some kind of other magics.
They're doing some other magics.
How do they do it, sir? Wait, 100 times smaller? I mean, that means really – because first off
– sub-millimeter.
First off, like when you talked about the antenna and the lines on an iPhone, for example, that's because the megahertz range that cell phone services are, and then the Wi-Fi range, you know, we've got 5 gigahertz, we know about 2.4 gigahertz. These are all have relatively – they're really high frequencies, and so their antenna variants are relatively small, like big enough to fit in your hand, not like an FM antenna, which is bigger. Okay.
Right. Banana ears like you have for TV for very high frequency. Very high frequency or
very lower frequency.
No, but they're called VHF.
Yeah.
Very high frequency.
Ultra. Yeah. UHF.
Even though they're lower. Anyway.
Well, at the time, UHF was extremely high frequency, right?
Yeah.
And the reason why we think of, you know, there's even higher frequency and such is because we got better at electronics. So go on.
What they were finding, what they were playing around with was that you have electromagnetic waves and you have acoustic waves. And while they are not related, like for example, a radio signal is just an electromagnetic wave. It does not have an acoustic component.
When you
component
say acoustic, you mean vibration, like physical vibration.
Like, well, vibration of air, yes.
Or vibration of any material is acoustic.
Sure. Okay. But in general, we think of it in terms of air. When we're listening to this program right now, it is the vibration of air that allows you to hear it.
That hits the eardrum. And,
So that's when we think of acoustic. So what they're doing is taking multiple materials, and I'm not going to pretend that I understand all of this.
Describe it and we'll figure it out. Yeah.
I would actually recommend people come and read the article itself. But you're talking about this mini antenna is taking advantage of a quirk of physics to translate that electromagnetic radiation into through a medium to an acoustic
What's the inner membrane that they're talking about? Are they talking about like a piezoelectric thing?
Yes.
Or capacitor?
Yes. So they have a piezomagnetic material and they have a piezoelectric material. And you're converting these oscillations from electrical voltage to
physical.
Physical.
And that's really interesting because one of the problems you have with this, if you conceptualize electromagnetic waves as a standing wave, is that its characteristic itself defines the length. The reason why we say an antenna has to be a certain length is because you have a harmonic oscillation, and that harmonic oscillation will only occur in frequency steps of certain lengths. And if you get smaller and smaller and smaller, you get to the point where the oscillation won't happen efficiently. Other frequencies will happen efficiently. But that's all assuming the entire time you're resonating electrons. And if you're resonating something else that has different properties of resonance, like a physical resonation, which is the vibration that you're talking about in the harmonic state or the...
Or an acoustic resonation. Everything acoustic is physical. Yeah.
Then you're basically stepping into a different vibration. It makes sense that... Well, think about it this way. If you take a...
Now, bear in mind, we're talking about stuff that people who are at the height of their game in electrical engineering are dealing with, and therefore it is kind of like... There's a lot of hand-waviness going on right now, and the only reason why I gave this any credence was because it came from a reputable magazine, science magazine, and it comes from a reputable source, which is Ethan Wang, an electrical engineer at the University of California, Los Angeles, who helped develop the idea,
and they have,
along with Rudy Diaz, who's from Arizona State University in Tempe. So
they know what they're doing.
Right. It's not just a random person coming on in a carny cart. You know?
They actually have results too. But if we can think of it this way, in that if you have a piece of glass of a certain length and thickness, and then you also have the same dimensions in steel and another dimensions in wood, if you were attach a string to these and thwong them with some kind of mallet, you would, even though they're the same sizes, you would have different frequencies of sound coming out of them because of the mass of the material and their flexing capabilities. The steel would probably resonate the longest. But in any case, different materials are going to resonate at different frequencies. And so it kind of makes sense that you could do this. But we're talking about like gigahertz range, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they're doing something besides just resonating mass. They're also doing some kind of like feedback with the piezoelectric. The piezoelectric is a crystalline structure that when you give it
hand
charge.
Hand-wavy quantum.
Yeah, I know. I know the thing I love that, like when I was talking about resonating electrons, I was trying to express that that's metaphorical because they're not really waves and they're not really particles and they're both and all that. We won't get into that. But it does. So a piezoelectric system is a crystal that changes its size by electrical charge, or you should say electrical charge changes its size, or you change its size, it produces electricity. So it's a electrical size variation system. And so these are the things that if you have a gas stove and you hear a click, 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 and then the thing ignites, what's happening is a little machine is hitting a crystal with a little hammer. And that little – when it hits effectively, it produces electric charge. It's pretty big, and that lights the gas on your stove. Lighters that also have a clicking, same thing. Those wand things are the same way. That's piezoelectric. Also, we use piezoelectric in condenser microphones. A condenser microphone is actually a – well, no, sorry. Piezoelectric microphones are one. Condenser is a different thing. But piezoelectric microphones and buzzers. So there's like beep, 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 alarm clocks. That's a piezoelectric speaker. Anyway, I love this space.
What was also really exciting for me to hear was they were saying that it sent and received signals at 2.5 gigahertz, which just so happens to be about what Wi-Fi is.
Yeah, sure.
2.1, I think, is Wi-Fi.
How efficient was it?
That was 100,000 times more efficient. So
than traditional antennas?
Yes, which kind of makes sense.
Whoa.
If you make something very small, the amount of movement doesn't have to be as much, or the interaction doesn't have to be as large.
But if the antenna is more efficient, then it's going to be better.
It means you're going to use less power for send receive, right?
Are they successful in receiving and sending? Can they inject electricity in the system too?
Yes, they were sending and receiving.
Oh my god. This is going to be totally fundamentally game changer.
Yeah.
Oh yeah,
game changer. Because right now your phone, the fact that it is sending and receiving signals is the single biggest reason the battery dies. The screen is number 2.
If it's more efficient, I wonder if it's more efficient at receiving the energy off of that as well. I wonder if you could use this as an energy transfer as well, or if it's just a really good noise floor.
Well, you just need to figure out what your signals are. You need to figure out what the highs and lows are.
Yeah. So this is going to be a big, sensitive enough information, game changer. Yeah. If it can be reproduced and it'll be put in math. What do these things look like?
Well, they're submillimeters, so I don't know.
They don't look like anything. That's really cool.
I mean, this is, you know, antennas that are on the tip of your fingernail type of thing.
Like, I was just working on Wi-Fi at my house, and I was researching a new Wi-Fi access point because my Wi-Fi is not 5 gigahertz, so it's not as fast, and I want to get it faster. And so I was looking at some Ubiquiti systems, and I was watching a video kind of explaining their product line, because Ubiquiti has a whole – we talked about Ubiquiti before with the Edge router, which is a really great cheap router for home, like – awesomeness. It's a really good show with Alex Slias.
Yeah, search the GeekSpeak site. Yeah. It's a great show.
Any case, Ubiquiti Edge Router X is the one for that one. But Ubiquiti has a whole line of Wi-Fi, including also some external ones and also some mesh network systems, and they're all slightly different. And I was like, what do I want? So I watched a YouTube video of someone kind of going, here's these models and what they're for. And it's someone that actually goes and sets up at universities and stuff, so they kind of know the field. And so I was talking, and one thing he screwed up on his article is this one has a higher range because they make it a special range one, and you can tell the dome is bigger because it's got larger antenna. And his assumption there makes total sense. He's like, but of course, if you've got a phone that doesn't have a long-range broadcast, it won't work anyway. And he's wrong there. Antennas are – when you have a better antenna, it means you can transmit more and you can detect better. So if you have a crappy antenna and I have a really, really good antenna, we can communicate. It doesn't mean that you can't send signals to me. Your weak signal, I will pick up because my antenna is better. And you'll pick up my signal because my antenna is bigger. So it doesn't really work that – they work better if they're better. It doesn't – it's – yeah, anyway.
Or there is a limiting factor, because if both sides have really good antennas, then the signal is much better. You can transmit more data. But this is definitely an area where if people should start brainstorming. Like, I think of this is now at the level where it's at the lab. So now people should start brainstorming. What do you do when the antenna size is not a big deal anymore?
Yeah.
And so you're talking about, oh, you swallow a pill that has an antenna in it.
Well, yeah, if it's extremely efficient, then, you know, even if it's only going to
– swallow a very small pill for that matter.
But you're not going to use 2.5 gigahertz.
Because it doesn't go through water.
No.
Side note, that same frequency we use for Wi-Fi, which is an unregulated radio frequency spectrum. That's why they chose it for Wi-Fi. It was just the Wild West going out there. Is the same frequency that microwave ovens use. And the reason why microwave ovens use that frequency is because that is the resonant frequency of water. So water molecules will start to vibrate when you apply energy at that frequency to there. And that's what heats up your food, is the heating of the water molecules within the material, which is also why if you have something that's completely dry, it doesn't heat as well. If it doesn't have water in it, it doesn't heat as well.
Well, in fact, if it doesn't have any water in it, it doesn't heat at all.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's the frequency.
And can harm your microwave oven because it's just.
The frequency that the water molecule resonates at is 2,450 megahertz. And Bluetooth is 2,483 megahertz, 0.5 megahertz. And Wi-Fi is 2,400.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's what they normally label. So they're all around the same frequency. And it's actually one of the reasons why that frequency was up for grabs is it's kind of crap for a planet with lots of water in it.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, as a side note, just because we brought up that side note, the footnote to the footnote is the reason why you don't worry about your cell phone cooking you is because the energy levels with regard to a microwave oven are dramatically different than what you would get from a cell phone.
Yeah.
So your microwave oven, does it work off of a battery? Not too well. You need to plug it into a wall socket, and that wall socket needs to have a minimum level of amperage.
So I don't know if I don't know if I mentioned this on the show already, but
amp-rating.
A while ago I bought these Bluetooth headphones that I'm wearing around my neck. You see that I wear them almost all the time now.
I don't think they see at all.
Well, you see. I was talking to you. They're the Leofil. Leofil? What do you call it? Leofil? Liophile? Leofile?
Leofile.
Leofile. Yeah. Bluetooth headset. And I got
Lion
them.
Lion lover.
I got Curious. Them because they're waterproof, and I have a pool, and I'm swimming a lot. And so they go around the neck, and then they plug in your ears, and they kind of clip in the front, and they're great. I mean, I'm really happy with them. Battery lasts forever on them. I never think about it, which is great. So I go swimming, and because they're around my neck, and I'm not hovering above the water, they sit in the water as I'm swimming. Yeah, Bluetooth doesn't work through water. So I got this headset specifically so I could listen to podcasts while I work out in my pool. And even with my phone precariously, dangerously close to the side of the pool on a wooden chair, it doesn't work at all.
Right. But to give a point of context, if you had a car battery hooked up to an inverter to run your microwave oven, it would not run very long.
No.
And that's a full truck car battery. At the same note, the battery size on a cell phone, much smaller, even though, you know, they have phablets these days, but they're still comparatively speaking to a truck battery, very small, but it runs your phone, for some people anyway, all day long.
Yeah.
That's the relative power outage output that we're talking about here with regard to even though they're the same frequency, your cell phone is never going to be that health hazard that would be if you stuck your head in a microwave.
Another note, though, about microwave energy is it actually is more efficient to heat water-based stuff in a microwave than to create radiant heat and trap it. I mean, it can be effectively similar in the sense that if you produce the heat really well and have a great insulator to keep the heat inside a box with your food, fine. But a microwave is not heating the air around the food first. It's heating the food. And so that's why it's such a more efficient and fast way to warm things.
It's not heating. A lot of people think of microwave ovens as heating from the inside out. They're not. No. They're heating. When they hit the outside molecules of water, those are heating up, and then it heats up.
Refer back 30 seconds to Bluetooth energy and water and pools.
Right.
Yeah. It goes to the outside first.
But at the same time, think about when you're heating up something. Let's say you're heating spaghetti, you know, boiling water for spaghetti. The amount of time it takes to get that water to a boil, you know, to get that pasta to the boil, to that heat that you want it to be, is about the same amount of time it takes for it to finally cool off and now it's too cold to eat. Microwave ovens, on the other hand, you put something in there, you heat it for 15 seconds, and then it takes 10 minutes to cool down again.
Right. Keep in mind also that when you are the shape of the food matters a lot in a microwave oven. Mm-hmm. The reason why they're rotating all the time is so they hit it at the right angle. If you know the way to put stuff in a microwave oven, you don't have to have it rotate, and you can heat it even more efficiently.
You also want to increase the surface area.
Yeah, increase the surface area. And if you have it low, the microwaves are not like going from side to side. They're going from like side to side, up and down, all over the place. So having it flat like a pancake on the bottom is actually a pretty efficient way to heat things, and it's easier than hanging the pancake in the middle of the microwave. Hey, we're going to talk about Amazon and Whole Foods, and we're talking about ancient Babylonia stuff and also other things. But first, I want to remind you, I'm Lyle Troxell, and I'm speaking with Miles Elam, and we're chatting, like we do every week, about technology. We're supported by some really amazing people. The show we've been doing for, I guess we're in season 17 right now, so 17 years about, and Miles and I volunteer our time. We've been doing so for years. And in the last year, we've had some people participate by giving us money every month, and it's really helped out on the costs of our servers and things of that night, and also to research better shows. So I want to thank Chris Irwin, Pat Hedder, Jeremy Devine, Jim Warner, Glenn Nelson, Luke Pigeon, David Leap, and I know I'm pronouncing his name wrong, but I'm sorry, David. Dave Holloway, Alexis Chen, Narajis Clenius, John Winson, and 20 more wonderful people. And anonymous people, actually. If you'd like to help us support the show, please do visit us at geekspeak.org/support. All right, Miles. Did you know, I know you know this, but Amazon bought Whole Foods a while ago, and they bought them for a lot of money, $1 something billion.
Except that the stock price for Amazon went up and to the point where it was essentially free, but
that's beside the point.
That's the
$13.7 billion is what they spent it on. Now, Amazon took over Whole Foods and basically, as soon as it could, implemented a up to 43% decrease in produce and things that they sell. So, for example, whole trade organic bananas on
decrease in price. Yeah. I don't think you mentioned word price.
They decrease in price. So you go to the store and you buy bananas.
I was thinking like the volume of it.
Right.
No, it's price.
Now on August 24th, you go to Whole Foods and you buy organic bananas, a pound of them. They cost 99 cents. On August 28th, they cost 69 cents, a decrease of 30%. And there's a whole bunch of examples of this. Fuji apples per pound, they drop from $3.49 to $1.99 per pound.
And is this if you have a Prime membership?
I don't think it's Prime membership based.
Because I've been seeing some news that Prime members actually get deeper discounts.
Maybe it's the Prime membership. I'm not sure. I didn't follow that aspect of it. The thing that's interesting is that why they're doing this. Basically, if you take a look at Whole Foods versus something like, I don't know, Walmart, you're going to see a giant increase in cost. Like the cost to go to Whole Foods is higher than at Walmart. So they're decreasing the price probably to be more competitive with the Walmarts and the other stores that offer a cheaper rate. I mean, of course, the one thing you can say about Amazon is that they barely make a profit, right? They're really good at getting their costs down as low as possible and just grabbing pennies off the top and, of course, making a lot of money doing so. But that's been their strategy the entire time. The other thing that you can do at Whole Foods now is you can go and buy an Amazon Echo or an Echo Dot. There and you know, $99 for the larger one and $50 for the smaller one. I find it fascinating that they're starting to throw electronics in definitely a grocery store. But of course, if you think of the customer base that they don't have, which is people that are not going on Amazon and buying stuff, if you give them something shiny that allows you to buy stuff on Amazon, that's actually a great market position for them. Like it makes a lot of sense for Amazon to be selling the smart, you know, invasion of your home tool right at the grocery store.
Yay.
Do you have a smart home device that listens to you all the time?
I don't.
I have two of them now. And I got to say, I have Amazon devices and can't use Google Play through them is driving me crazy.
I came across that with the players. Like I had a Chromecast and it didn't support Amazon Prime Video.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I got an Amazon TV stick. And it didn't support Google Video. And I was like, "What? Come on." Ended up getting a Roku, which supports both.
Yeah, Roku does a great job. The other one that does a good job is Apple,
Apple TV.
Supposedly next week when they release the new product line, they'll be releasing an Apple TV 4K. The thing about Apple TV is the remote's not so great. So I have the Apple TV at home. I've got a PlayStation most recent. I don't know what they're called. These are all like work devices that I've been playing with. And the navigation systems are just get in the way. You know, it's so frustrating. TV remotes just, even if they're a game controller, frustrating. All right, let's move on, shall we?
Absolutely.
Do tell me all about Babylonian tablet.
Well, first let's start with the Babylonian number system.
Yeah, I heard that it's interesting.
Fascinating,
right?
Area. If you like that kind of thing, a lot of people we talk about on the show different base systems, like base 16 is a huge one in computer programming, hexadecimal, because it's a number system that is close enough to our base 10 system that we can kind of figure it out, but maps very neatly to a base, to a binary system where each character, each digit, you know, 0 to F as opposed to 0 to 9, maps to exactly to 4 bits. So if you have two characters, you know it's an 8-bit value, 4 characters is a 16-bit value, and on, which you absolutely cannot do with a base 10 system, which is our...
Doesn't Babylonian is base 10, isn't it?
It is not.
What is it?
Babylonian is base 60.
Why?
Because 60 is the most useful base to use if you want to evenly divide a number by 2, 3, or 5.
Yeah.
So 2, 3, 4, and 5. Like 2, 3, 4, 5. All those basic numbers.
I thought 12 was pretty good as well. I mean, it doesn't get 5, but...
That's the thing. You do 12, you get 2, 3, 4. You can divide them evenly. You multiply by 5, you get 60.
Yeah.
And what the Babylonians did, and this is what they found out from a tablet that's recently been discovered.
But their notation system does have deca representation in it. Even if they have a base system of 60, they still do have notation that they don't have a character up to 60.
The notation is based upon base 60.
Okay, go on.
The cuneiform marks are a base 60.
Okay, go on.
So this is a civilization that hit its peak 4,000 years ago. Now, we think of trigonometry in general as being the realm of the Greeks. And so we say, oh, yeah, the ancient Greeks figured out trigonometry, and that was 2,000 years ago or 2,500 years ago, something like that. However, this tablet predates Pythagoras by almost 1,000 years.
The tablet that does this trick.
Yes, they found archaeologists found a 3,700-year-old tablet. And after they examined it, they realized it was a trig table. So ratios of lengths of sides of triangles. What we normally do in trig with a unit circle and angles. And we figure out,
theta.
Right. But we have them based upon, we have 30 degrees, 45 degrees, 60 degrees, 90 degrees. That's how we split things off, and that's how we did the math. And so you end up with these, the square root of 2 over 2 values all over the place. And it ends up being very either square root heavy or very decimal heavy.
Mm-hmm.
However.
That's a great way to describe it, yeah.
Yeah, well. All with relationship to pi.
Does a base 60 system help you with this?
Yes, because all of these ratios, when you're using a base 60 system to figure out your trig table, all of the numbers end up even.
No.
By virtue of the fact that you're working in base 60. The reason why they don't end up even is because when you and I learn trig, we're working in a base 10 number
system.
Right,
we're transferring back to base 10 all the time to get a value out of it, if you will.
Yes.
That's kind of cool. So when was this found? Is this a recent find?
This is a fairly recent find, yes. Now, if you say, wait, what does this matter at all? Look at your clock, assuming you have an analog clock still. 60 seconds to a minute.
Yeah.
Thank the Babylonians for that. That's where it came from.
That makes sense. So interesting. I'm looking at the Babylonian number system on the Wikipedia entry, and they clearly have notations. Take a look at this, Miles. Clearly have notations that's similar to Roman numerals and that they've got slashes and such. And they clearly have notations of 1 through 60, right? 1 through 59, but, equivalently, which are repeating in decimal, in dec-based systems. So they've got, a way of counting up to 9 and then another symbol for 10 and so on.
Yes, you are correct.
So they still have a pattern that breaks it down. Because I would imagine that, you and I know our 9 characters, or 9 digits, right? But if you had 60 digits to memorize, it'd be a lot harder for you to keep that in scope. So having it broken...
The shape of it is a lot to do with it, because these are not the digits that we are used to. They are a collection of straight hash marks.
Effectively, it's very much like Roman numerals, so you can count them, if you will.
Yeah. It's something that you have to be able to read and write using a straight read... a reed on soft clay is how they were made.
Very cool. Well, let's talk about forklifts.
The forklift is yet another area that touches upon automation, where we talk about the loss of jobs with regard to you have a computer that is able to do everything that a human being would do in that role. A forklift is yet another one, and this is the maker being Seagrid. where this, you know, this forklift can find something, you know, scan a barcode, pick up a pallet of items, take it over to where it needs to go, raise it up, drop it off, move on to something else. In other words, what you would have a human being driving a forklift would
yes.
do. Which ends up being actually a non-trivial portion of a warehouse job for a human being
mm-hmm.
is now poised to be automated away.
And it makes sense. You have a completely controlled environment. You don't have weather situations. You've got a clean floor. You can have, of course, multiple of these things going along and mm-hmm. one human to deal with it when it breaks. Yeah.
And you don't have the liability when something falls on it.
Have you seen some of the video of automated warehouses of Amazon's and such where the pallet forklifts, if you will, are simply like small, short robots that go under the pallets and inflate and lift things up and move around? It's
yep.
incredible.
Yep. And they also have things like when some – maybe I'm thinking of Newegg where something would come up and it would roll it over onto a pallet, a little train system that would
yeah.
go around. And then when it got to the end, that's when a person finally packaged it up and put it into the box.
You know, I first off, we got to clarify that this is totally in the scope of robots taking over human jobs. And the concern – I don't want to – lessen the concern of our society drastically changing because of this occurring. I was reminded recently, total tangent. Are you done with the story?
Well, yes.
Okay. I was reminded recently of the lack of some services we currently don't have some services that it would be really nice to have in the Santa Cruz area. And years ago, and specifically having like stores that you can go in and buy stuff in electronic realm. At one point, there was a large explosion of stores where you could buy a whole bunch of electronics. And over time, that's been replaced by online accounts and such. I recall, I believe it was a Circuit City. Circuit City is no more, right?
Is no more.
Circuit City used to exist in Capitola. In Capitola. And it was one of those times where I was asked for a quote about Circuit City being closed. We covered on the show about it closing and all that. And I think the local paper contacted me and got a quote. And then after reading the article, I sounded like completely a jerk, right? Because my thought process was all about the future. And, well, you can buy stuff online and shipping's cheap and, you know, all these great aspects mm-hmm. of it, not the 30 people that lost their job in my hometown, right?
Right.
So clearly there's a – I get excited about technology and we play in that space of being, you know, embracing it, understanding it, digging into it, and all that requires us to be passionate about it. But of course, there's side effects that we don't like at the same time. Of course, we bring that kind of stuff up all the time. So I don't want to lessen the fact that, yes, you know, warehouse work is going to decrease and decrease and decrease. It's going to be more and more automated over time. That is a problem for that whole sector. I'm hoping, of course, optimistically that I am, that our society will change in such a way that it won't, it will improve everyone's lives, not just take from some people.
Yes, but we do need to be more empathetic towards one another.
I agree.
Even though we can think it's really cool that this, you have this forklift that works without a human operator on its day-to-day, and it doesn't even need advanced technologies like LiDAR,
right.
like cars do, because it's... it's a warehouse, which means that you have very common lighting.
Very controlled, yeah.
And you have, like, the lighting is good in general, and you have very clear lanes.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, you can throw tape down and make it really easy. So what I was trying to do recently was deal with a new drive. I bought this – okay, Miles, last week after the Geek Speak, you said you got to take a look at mSATA, these
mm-hmm.
very small memory sticks, which are used – inside, like, our laptops.
Oh, yeah. Did yours come?
Yeah. So I bought a 500 gigabyte mSATA drive, and these things can have a throughput, depending on the connection type, of, like, 300 megabits per second, which is really good.
Megabytes
per second. Excuse me. Which is really good. Not like a flash drive, which is, what, 10 megabytes per second? I'm not even sure what a flash drive can do.
Well, SD card, I find that you can get a burst of, you know, between 90 and 100, or some of them get even faster
yeah.
than that, but... Your random access, if you're using it like a normal drive, you're getting closer to 10 or lower.
Right. So this enclosure that I got was like $15, and I think $150 for the actual 500 gigabyte drive.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole thing's the size of a large, you know, pack of gum. like those little
Zippo lighter.
Yeah, Zippo lighter, that kind of size. So I bought this thing, and of course, I decided to go ahead and go with USB-C because my primary machine has USB-C ports.
And it's the future. In the future, you're not going to have new laptops that are going like, hey, you know what, let's just stick with USB 3.0. They're not. They're just not.
So yours has a USB micro B, which is that USB connector type that's kind of wide, that has like two sections in it.
And if I had thought about it, I'm still kicking myself. If I had thought about it, I would have gotten USB-C.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the connector to my laptop is going to be USB. The connector to my Raspberry Pi is USB. But that USB-C cable, you know, or that USB-C connector on that device will eventually be USB-C to USB-C on some future device.
So the unit I got was a USB-C to USB-C to USB B. Is this B? Yeah, that's B.
Yes, this is B. What you find on laptops in general is a B. A is usually what you find on the device you're connecting to.
Yeah, it's more square.
Yeah.
But the standard way you think of a USB...
Or, it's a Pentagon?
Yeah. No, it's like a... It's like a house with a top.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So, in any case, the USB B connector is the one that is actually it's a fourth dimensional device, and you know that because when you try to plug in a USB port, it doesn't work. So you flip it over, and it doesn't work. And you flip it over again, and then it works.
Yes, the superposition of USB
clearly a superpositional item going through the fourth dimension, obviously. So, in any case, my little box has a USB connector on it, and then the cable that comes with it is a USB-C to USB-B, so it could plug right into your laptop and work great. However, it cannot plug into my laptop and work great because my laptop doesn't have USB-C Bs. It has USB-C only. And so I grabbed the cable, which, of course, my charging cable is a USB-C to USB-C cable, and I plugged that in, and I got less than 90 megabits per second. I said, well, that's not what I wanted. So is my drive bad, or am I doing something wrong? So then I went through a whole bunch of deviations of what I could theoretically do. I don't have a lot of USB-C to USB-C. In fact, I only have the one that comes with the Apple charger. And here at the office—
And you don't have a dock of any kind?
I've got a dock that has USB-C, yes. But when I plug—
Or USB-B.
USB-B. But when I plug that in, I got a warning from my machine saying that's not appropriate. Because USB-C on these laptops is actually also a Thunderbolt line. And when the device plugs in, it has to declare what type it wants to be. Do you want to be a Thunderbolt connector? Do you want to be a power thing? Do you want to be a USB-C or USB 3.1? And so the cables themselves actually have the smarts in them that tell the connector bus what's going on. So when you use my little dongle thing and pop it on, it informs the system what it's for. And it's not for then... It doesn't do what you want it to do. So I was like, and the other side effect of this is that when I started to deal with transferring the data, I was like, well, it's going to be slow. It's not great. When I plugged in my 4 terabyte drive that has a USB-C micro B connector on it, that's the flat one that's wide and split, it didn't work. That's weird. It worked the other day. And then I realized it didn't work again. I tried a different cable and a different cable, and finally it worked. And then if I shifted it, it didn't work. The surface mount connector on my 4 terabyte drive had gone askew because I had left the cable plugged in. Do not leave cables plugged into portable devices that you don't want to break the connectors on. They're just never designed strong enough.
Well, the cheap ones aren't anyway.
This one was not cheap. Trust me, a 4 terabyte portable drive, a really small one, is not a cheap thing. So I go home, I take the 4 terabyte drive apart, and it was thicker than I expected to be. Do you know why it was thicker than I expected to be? Because it had 2 SATA drives in it, sandwiched back to back, with a small proprietary RAID card on it, which means that if I can't get that solder connector back on, I don't get my data off those drives because it's a stripe and I...
Oh, it's using RAID 0? I was thinking...
I don't know what it's using. It's 4 terabytes in both the drives.
If it was RAID 1, I could see like just a reliability issue just to make sure.
No. It's a 4 terabyte drive they sold me. Inside is 2 2 terabyte drives taped together with some kind of proprietary board with a really bad connector on it that's popped off. And I'm like, ugh. So I pulled out my soldering iron. First, I went all night. I like tried taping it and all that, and it popped, finally broke off and no good. So I pull out my soldering iron and hope, because every other time I've tried to surface, you know, re reheat surface mount connectors, especially connectors, because what's happening is there's this really delicate pins, but there's actually also the body shield. And the body shield needs a lot of heat to get it soldered a wick onto it. But the little tiny pins are very delicate. If you add extra solder, then they'll merge together, and now they're not a connector anymore.
It's the kind of thing that an automated process does, not a human being.
I definitely needed a robot. So I did what I thought would work, and I was able to get my data off. It's actually slowly transferring data off. The reason, and I have a copy of everything on there. Like that's a drive that goes with me. So obviously I've got backups, except that because it had been slowly failing, I kept on failing to get backups of it. And you know, I'd go, okay, yeah, back to my NAS tonight, and the next day I'd have an error, and I'm like, oh, that's annoying, cancel, close, whatever, go to work. Every time I've had data integrity backup problems, it's because that stupid user that's involved in the situation was failing, namely me.
Because heck, problem exists between keyboard and chair.
Definitely, because for the last month, I've been going, oh, I'll have to back that up later. Oh, I'll have to back that up later. It was an error of some sort. So the drive has theoretically some pictures that I don't have on it of my trip and things of that nature and some other stuff, some old GeekSpeak episodes that I hadn't backed up successfully. So I've been slowly working on this. The other thing, of course, is that I went to try to find a USB to USB-C cable so that I could actually do all this work on my faster computer. Unfortunately, we don't have a Circuit City in Santa Cruz anymore. So I couldn't buy a USB-C to USB-C cable.
So where'd you go?
I waited. I contact Amazon, and it'll be at home when I get home today. I went to Kmart.
How'd that work out for you?
You know, it's amazing to me that, okay, the only reason you would possibly go buy some cable at Kmart is because you're losing data on a drive that's going to fail soon.
You need it right
now. And you need it right now. So I go in there and I'm thinking,
well, I don't know that I would go to Kmart for
that. I only
that.
Did because, like, where else am I going to go? I was in Scotts Valley and Felton area, right? I'm not in Capitola. We actually have a Best Buy, I think, that probably has the cable I needed.
I almost wonder if Ace Hardware would do better.
I almost wondered that too. But the point of it is that we can get the cheapest cable possible and the best, you know, with reviews and all that by going online, doing some research for 10 minutes, and it will be mailed to us within a day and a half, right? So the only thing the stores, the local stores, have is immediacy. And I would have paid a lot of money for that cable if they'd had it, right? Instead, they had like 12 different Lightning to USB cables. Mm-hmm. Not even Lightning to USB-C, because of course no USB-C in the store at all. But the thing is, if the person stocking that store just thought, what are people going to need and how can I take their money? It's the rarity item. It's the one-off $50 cable. You're going to be able to gouge someone for it if it's going to work. In any case, I was a little frustrated and I tweeted my frustration and 700 people said, you idiot, why'd you go to Kmart?
Really, 700 people?
No. Hey, you know what?
No, what?
It's the end of another episode of GeekSpeak.
Already?
Have you heard, Miles, that GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and used with permission? Because I've said it every day for years and years. And also that GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, so anybody can use our stuff any way they like. They can even make money off of it as long as they give us credit for the content. Why do we do that, Miles? Why do we give away our show?
Well, one, there's the what recording executives refer to as the analog hole, which we call reality. But there's also that feeling of like remix, get it out there. Like,
yeah,
what's the worst thing that's going to happen to us?
Nothing.
We're gonna get paid less for it.
We don't get paid anyway.
I mean, the show gets donations, and we're thankful for that. But that goes to hosting.
Like, yeah, definitely. The theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music, and today's title is Babylonian NSA Finds Tiny Antennas at Whole Foods. Thank you, Greg Merkley, for our title. This is episode 31 of season 17. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me is Miles Elam. Miles, thank you so much for joining me.
Always a pleasure.